Let's talk about creation tonight. This is my Father's world, the hymn says. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my Father's world. The battle is not done. Jesus who died shall be satisfied, and earth and heaven be one. This is my Father's world. Should my heart be ever sad, the Lord is King, let the heavens ring. God reigns, let the earth be glad. This is my Father's world, now closer to heaven bound, for dear to God is the earth Christ trod, no place but his holy ground. And hear the words of the psalmist, Psalm 24:1. The earth and everything in it, the world and its inhabitants, belong to the Lord. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is the second time we've looked at this verse. First, we talked about it in our doctrine of God. And part of my answer to Bob just a few minutes ago was kind of rooted in some of what we talked about when we talked about the doctrine of God, that God is presented in the earliest pages of the Bible. Let me try to put that all, that whole conversation, both in our doctrine of God discussion and tonight, in a nutshell. I find it interesting that the Bible does not open with a discourse on the existence of God. I just find that interesting. If you were writing the Bible, that's probably where you would start, don't you think? Here are all the reasons I think God exists.
That would be our human nature to try to prove something that somebody else does not prove.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we want to demonstrate. Well, we wanted to get, and on top of that, like, hey, this is the Bible. It's his book. We need to kind of start to demonstrate who this person is and try to convince people he exists. It's interesting to me that the Bible takes God's existence for granted and presents him as such. But I think part of the reason for that is that's not a weakness of the Bible. That's a strength of the Bible, because part of what I was just saying to Bob is, in reality, if you started with all that, eventually you're going to come around to, well, something had to make this. Okay? So God just introduces himself to begin with as creator. I think it's interesting to know that the first image we have of God is the image of creator. This is where everything came from. And I think a lot of the ills of the world today have come from the loss of an understanding of having a creator. Okay? So even I've heard historians and others talk about even something like the history of the word atheist. As we know it, an atheist is someone who doesn't believe God exists at all. But that's a very recent understanding of that word. Historically, that word in the past would have meant more something like someone who lives as if God doesn't exist at all. A kind of full apostasy or a infidel. It's being an infidel. It's an apostate. So forever, the social imaginary, let's say, or the understanding of folks, what I think it's Charles Taylor would have called first and second world brains. People throughout history have assumed there was a God and assumed that they were created. And so it's only in very recent years that you've begun to have people who believe in something other than createdness about the world as we know it. So even just words like the universe or even cosmos is a little tighter toward theism, but just not even calling it creation anymore. It shows you the kind of loss of a sort of general understanding of being created. And it almost literally opens up a whole Pandora's box of issues when you lose a theology of createdness. And so for us in our study of theology to begin to talk about creation, it's not simply just to say God is creator and this is his world, but it is to even then begin to think about what it means to have received the world. Okay? This is something we received from God. And so I think there are all sorts of errors that are coming out of what it means to lose a sense of createdness. So much of this has coincided with the Industrial Revolution and so many of the problems we have on the planet. Now, I'm not a full global warming guy or whatever else, but I don't think anybody's looking around and saying, you know, I think this place is prettier than it was 200 years ago. You know, I think the Coosa River is a lot healthier and nicer than it was 200 years ago. I don't think anybody's thinking that, you know. I bet that, you know, the Hudson River and the East River, best they've ever been. Nobody's saying that. But so interestingly enough, our sort of loss of theistic thinking and rise of industrialism and scienceism and those sorts of things seem to kind of coincide with a loss of a view of being stewards of the planet, right? What's the planet for if it wasn't given to you by God? Well, making as much money as you can make, right? Who cares what happens to it? It doesn't matter. I'm here to live for me now, and that's it. On the flip side, you now have folks who are beginning to value the planet, not as if it's created, but as if we're almost one with it, or as if it's more valuable than human beings. And they see humans almost as the problem in the world, almost like humans are a virus, which is also deeply problematic and a misunderstanding of what it means for us to be created. Well, Christianity, I think, does such a good job of positioning us to understand that this is God's world and that He has placed us as His stewards here, and He gave it to us for our benefit and enjoyment, but it still belongs to Him. And we ought to treat it as such. So I think we ought to think through these things. On top of that, you begin to lose a sense of what it means to treat creatures and your fellow man well. Interestingly enough, I've found it really funny. One of the things that kind of makes me laugh the most is how much Charles Spurgeon was an animal lover. He loved animals. He insisted on his horses being treated well, and he had really harsh words in his sermons for people who would misuse and abuse and mistreat animals. Now, again, you can ask my mother-in-law, who's probably the most pronounced animal lover I've ever met in my life. I'm not as much of an animal lover as I could be, right? I could do a lot better, I think. But this is part of what it means to be a Christian, is to consider that God made these creatures, right? And that we ought to be careful and care for them and not be cruel to animals. But then, even worse than that, I do think animal cruelty can oftentimes lead to a sort of human cruelty. All right, this is weird, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. So I think part of our problem too, how do I put this? The Israelites were forbidden from eating blood, right? Is everybody with me on this? Do you remember why God said they shouldn't eat blood? The life. Yeah, Ben's got it. He mouthed it because he didn't want to be that guy. But the life is in the blood. Now, that's interesting. He doesn't say the blood's unclean like he would some animals or whatever else. So you kind of lose a lot of theories people have that those dietary restriction laws were meant to prevent the Israelites from getting sick on oysters or whatever else, you know. The life is in the blood, which I find really interesting. Our great-great-great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents, what would they do if they wanted to eat chicken for dinner? Go out back and kill the chicken, right? And then what do you do after you kill a chicken? You drain the blood out of it, right? What do you do if you want chicken for dinner? You go to Popeye's, or you go to the store, and what do? You get it from a neat little package, right? A little cellophane package. It's like you're buying cereal almost, right? And you grill it, and you're totally disconnected from what it took, okay, for you to eat that meal. And so God, I think, though I do think as believers in Christ, your conscience is free to eat blood for those of you who want to enjoy a nice blood sausage with your fry up in the morning and your beans and toast or whatever. And those of you who want to eat, I don't personally eat blood as food. Because I don't enjoy it. B, because I still kind of want to be a little careful about this. And there is some questions there when the apostles say abstain from eating blood and from sexual immorality there. At the Jerusalem Council, they say that to Gentiles. So I try to be careful, though I don't bind everyone's conscience on that. An aside here, the pink juice that comes out of your steak is not blood, okay? That is hemoglobin-stained water, okay, and fat. So if you are Cooking your steak well done, because you don't want to, you think that's blood, you're welcome to cook your steak well done, but overcooking a steak doesn't make it kosher anyway, all right? So that's not part of the process for even the Israelites, and most modern butcher practices remove as much, if not more, blood out of a creature than ancient kosher butchering practice would have. So you're probably safe on whatever meat you choose to eat, okay? Have I thought about this too much? Yes, okay. But isn't it interesting, though, to think that our shrinking and diminishing view of the dignity and worth of human beings has seemingly coincided with our growing distance between where our food, where our meat comes from? I really think it's part of it. I don't think it's all of it, but I think it's part of it. That for all of human history, that, you know, there's something that's sickening to watch an animal die, and it's a reminder, I think, as we watch an animal die. It's a reminder to us of the preciousness of life. And it, I think seeing the life, according to the Bible, being drained out of a chicken in your backyard for you to live, impacts. And I haven't quite connected it all yet, so y'all are getting some iron ore here. But somehow or another impacts the way we view our neighbor. Okay, and there's just something about going to the grocery store. I'm working on a blog about this at some point, or a newsletter, and the opening line is, isn't it funny to think that people who believe in demons and haints and ghouls, isn't it funny that we think they're more disconnected from reality than people who get their chicken in tiny cellophane packages? And I think it's something about modernity that's makes it difficult for us to view our fellow man as someone who's what? Created in the image of God. Okay? And to know that you see a pig's blood and it looks a whole lot like our blood, right? And it does something about our view of the sanctity of life as a whole. But it also does something to impact our view of createdness and what it means to have received this world from God. And once we start to think that we've received this world from God, it becomes abundantly clear that He made man special and in His image. And so many of the panoply of ills that exist in this world really boil down to a loss and a lack of a view of all people created in the image of God. So many problems there. So many problems emerge from that. If you think about racism, abortion, the way we talk to each other, right? And the way we talk about each other. All sorts of ills, if we really believe human beings are created in the image of God, it impacts our view on each and every one of these issues. So it's not enough simply to say, God made the world, God called it good, and He put us here. That's where we begin. But I think it's important in moments when we get the chance to talk about creation that all of us have sort of grown up with secularism in the air, and I want to confront us a little bit with the loss of our vision and view of createdness, and a loss of our view of the specialness of God's creation. And so when we sing that great hymn, "This is my Father's world, oh let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet." That's an important thing for us to remember. This is our Father's world. So Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, the earth was without form and void. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, do you guys see that there's a separation here? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is what we call first creation. Creatio, theologians call it creation, or creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. Okay, maybe you've heard the joke before that a group of scientists went to God and they said, "We can create man. We've got all the technology we need to do to make man out of dust." And God said, "Okay, we'll see you do it." They said, "No, we really can. We know how to do exactly what it is you've done." And God says, "Okay, let's see you do it." And so they reach down and get a handful of dust, and says, God goes, "Wait, wait, wait. You need to get your own dust." God, God created everything out of nothing, okay? Creation out of nothing. God was God, the uncreated creator, okay? Before history ever existed, before the world ever existed, there are no people. At some point or another, there are no angels. Nothing exists except the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit in eternity past. And at some point or another, God had the thought, the decision, the decree, if you will. I will make something. Okay? And then God chooses to act on that decree, that decision. God speaks, though, when there's nothing. Only God exists, okay? There are no things. There is no stuff. There is nothing but God. There is no space. There is no heaven. There is God. And that's it, okay? God speaks, and he speaks into existence the heavens and the earth. And I think this includes heaven as we know heaven to be. This is amazing to think about. God in his power to be able to speak and worlds emerge, to be able to speak and not only worlds emerge, but just the fact anything emerges. Get your own dust, right? I mean, even just something like as simple as dirt happens because God speaks. It's an amazing thing to consider. And it's also important as we consider creatio ex nihilo or creation out of nothing. It's also, by the way, when I use terms like that, I'm not trying to like impress you with that or whatever. It's like, went to seminary, we get it. He's like, isn't that so cool? No. But I'm using that so as you read and as you engage, if some of you may want to engage deeper and further in literature, I want you to be familiar with these terms. Does that make any sense? Like, I want you to be able to be reading, be like, creatio ex nihilo, what does that even mean? I want you to kind of know. That means creation out of nothing. Okay, just so you know, I don't care to like throw big words around, but it's important for you to understand words are going to show up in literature if you decide to go deeper in some of these things. So also important as God created the world out of nothing, it's important to remember, and I think Grudem makes this point well in your chapter, that creation is separate from God. Okay? There's God, and then there's stuff. And those are two different things. Okay? For there to be stuff, there has to be a creator. Something had to make the stuff. Everybody thinks that. Stuff had to come from somewhere. Either in some infinite stuff somewhere, or a never-ending line of stuff, or the stuff's always been there, but the stuff, eternal stuff, is kind of harder to deal with to me than an eternal God. All that being said, the stuff is not God, okay? And so there are worldviews that see God as one with everything. There's a lot of New Age sort of mysticism that sees God as identical with the creation, that God is everything. This is pantheism, okay? Everything is God. And a lot of native religions, pagan religions, are something like this. Panentheism, if I'm not mistaken, is the view and understanding that God is a part of things. He's not identical with everything, but he is a part of things. And I think this is related in some ways later to something like process theology, that God is developing over time with the world that he did or did not create. But it's important to recognize God as separate, okay? Separate yet present, all right? Separate yet present. Classical theism, that's primarily rooted in the Christian tradition, but also theism is understood to be part and parcel also of Judaism and Islam, understand God to be not only separate, but also present in his creation and in his world. And this is over opposed to a view called deism, which the shorthand way to talk about this is the divine watchmaker theory. Okay? What does that mean? Well, God made this world like a watchmaker might make a watch, and he wound it up and let it start running and walked away. He's not present in the world. But so for God to be separate does not mean he is not present. Okay? And so there's a big difference between in him we live and move and have our being, which is what Paul teaches in Acts chapter 17, and God is everything, two different things. So God is present. Okay, but the world is dependent on God. He upholds the universe, Peter tells us, by the word of his power. Okay, so at any given moment, if God were to remove his hand from the world, if he were to decide he didn't want the world to exist, he doesn't really have to destroy it. He could just stop, and we would stop. Okay? At any given moment, everything that exists is upheld by the word of his power. So if you've seen the recent pictures from the space telescope looking out trillions and trillions of miles into the past somehow, and seeing space out there, every single bit of that is upheld by the word of the power of Christ. Okay? So it is, this creation is totally dependent on God. The Genesis account goes on, and Genesis 1:1 is what theologians call first creation, or creation out of nothing. But then God begins what theologians call second creation, which is the forming and filling of the world he had made. So chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And so it's kind of funny to me, a lot of people argue over whether the 7 days here are seven literal days or not. And I tend to think that they are. And if they aren't, they're finite periods of time. I mean, but here's the reality. If it's sort of like a thing, well, how could somebody create all that in just 7 days? Well, that's silly, because God created everything that exists in a moment. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's all. He created the earth in a moment, right? I mean, what's the difference? If you can speak and a sun appears, what does it matter if it's a full day or not, right? God did it, and he did it in as little or as much time as he wants to do it, okay? And I understand what people are trying to do, and I understand why a lot of theologians are really careful about not granting that this happened over long swaths of time, because they're a little nervous. Some are a little nervous about giving too much credence to some of the older theories and things like that. I don't get super riled up about that. All I want to be able to say is that God created the heavens and the earth. He spoke it into existence. He created it out of nothing, and he formed and filled the earth to make it a perfect place for man to inhabit. And I think there's a chance that there was a long period of time. I think I'm stealing all your questions, Ben. I think there's a chance there's a long period of time, for example, between chapter 1, verse 1 and chapter 1, verse 2. People call this a gap theory. There's no sense of how long it took for God to start to do this. I do find it interesting. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and what happens in verse 2? The earth was without form and void. Those words represent a sort of primordial chaos. This does not just mean it was dark, and no, it's almost got a negative connotation. The Hebrew term is tohu vabohu, which means formless and void. The only other place it's used is it implicates a sort of wasteland. Okay, so not just like a blank canvas, like you might want to imagine it, right? But even beyond that, there's a negative feel to it. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And so you see this sort of primordial chaotic waters. Interestingly enough, I think there's a parallel there with later in the flood, where God returns the creation back to that primordial chaos, right? And the waters cover the earth again, and then God brings his creation back out of it again. And some of the language you see here in Genesis 1 is repeated to Noah, but with a pronounced change. For example, when he talks about man being created in his image, it's in conjunction with the death penalty. So it's a remade world that's still marred by sin, but God is bringing his creation back out of this formlessness and void of the waters of his wrath. Just a little lanyap there for everybody. But God forms the earth, right? On days 1 through 3, verses 3 through 5 is day 1. He creates light. Day 2, water and sky. Day 3, land and vegetation. And so the Bible's presenting this as God forming the earth. And then he fills it correspondingly in the following days. Day 4, the luminaries are provided. Now it's interesting that God gave light to the world before he gave the sun and the moon. And again, you know, the people are like, how does that even work? How does any of this work? I don't know. It didn't exist yet. God did it, you know. And some people see this as a sign that this is just a poetic way of describing forming and filling. It's not exactly how I understand it, but I'm open. There's no question it's being presented in a poetic and beautiful way. It's unquestionable. That doesn't mean it's not a reflection of reality, though. The fish and the birds, so the light and the luminaries on days 1 and 4 correspond. The water and sky and the fish and the birds on days 2 and 5 correspond. And then the land and the vegetation and the beasts correspond on days 3 and 6. And God is moving toward a climax, toward a pinnacle of creation. And though he speaks all these things into existence, Grudem makes the point, and I think it's very helpful, that he does all this except for man, which he creates with his own hands and breathes life, his own life into, so to speak, by his spirit. And so we see there the way that man is a special pinnacle of creation. We're going to have a whole week on that. I would love to talk more about that, but we're going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait, okay? I got to keep you coming back for something. He was forming and filling, though, creation as a suitable place for mankind to live. And we'll talk a little bit more about how God is creating this world and this garden in particular as a kingdom for his little king to live in and to represent him and to be like him and to be fruitful and to multiply. And to Bible calls this the cultural mandate to subdue the earth, to subdue the creatures, and to cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. It's the cultural mandate, or third creatio tertia, the third creation. It's the work he gave Adam to do, right? To cultivate his good world. And that's a work we're still called to do. But God was forming and filling creation as a suitable place for mankind to live. So I think we need to remember God has lovingly designed a world which is perfect for human habitation, and it beautifully declares his glory. Over and over again, as God creates, the scripture says, and God saw that it was good. And so Christianity is set apart in this reality, as I've alluded to already. We see the world as a good creation of God, not an idol to worship, right? It's not an idol to worship. It's a creation of God. It's not a bad thing. Some religions and some philosophies over the years, Plato, for example, saw the material world, material existence, as a negative thing. We see it as a good gift of God. Not an idol to worship, not an inherently evil material world, but a good creation made by a good God that he gave us to enjoy. I want to just really quickly, as we start to kind of conclude, if you have any questions, we'll entertain those in just a moment. I want to read to you a little bit from the 19th Psalm. This Easter of this year, I preached a Christian worldview series, so to speak, on creation, fall, redemption, restoration. I preached from Psalm 19, so you might want to check that sermon out at some point. I've also preached through Genesis and preached through these early chapters of Genesis. I think it was in 2017, it was a series called Beginnings, when I started the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and I concluded those a couple years ago. But if you're interested in those sermons, I can go track them down for you, send you the links. Let me just read to you a little bit about David's psalm here, talking about creation. To the choir master, a psalm of David. David, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. And so here we see a little bit of a picture of God's creation as it ought to be. Okay, David is talking about not the fallenness of the world, but those aspects of the world that still reflect God's glory and the way God wants things to be. I'm sorry, I'm looking for something that didn't quite make my notes. So we see the way the heavens are speaking first, and the way that the world around us reveals a creator. This is a parallel to Paul's logic in Romans chapter 1, right? We talked about that a few weeks ago. You guys remember this? We talked about general revelation. That's part of what Paul's alluding to here. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. And the sky above proclaims handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. That which is known about God is plain to them, Paul says in Romans 1. It's a really similar thought to what David's saying here in 19. But we also see the way that God's creation reveals his good design. Not only is the sky speaking here in the heavens, the firmament, so to speak, speaking in this passage, but also the sun is not without witness. In them, God has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. God's creation reveals his good design. David uses the sun as an example, and there are things we now know about the sun that David had no clue about, but that boggle the mind to consider the way just the sun. David knew enough to know the way the sun runs its course every day, so to speak, is such a sign of God's good design. Let me just say a word about David's language here. This is poetic, everyone. A lot of people think that this means that David thinks the sun moves. Okay? David doesn't think the sun moves. Even more, King David doesn't think the sun moves. Any more than David Simmons thinks the sun moves when he says what time the sunrise is in the morning. Right? Nobody here, unless you're Neil deGrasse Tyson, nobody here is going to try to have this like super specific language about everything that happens, right? So when you say the sun rose in the morning, what are you saying? Well, from your perspective, the sun is in a fixed position. We move, right? But from your perspective, right, the sun is rising, correct, and setting. This is called phenomenological language. That is, we often use language in the course of human history, and everyone, from the most smart people to the least smart people, use language that describe phenomenon as they see them, not always as they are. Okay? So the Bible, when the Bible uses phenomenological language, we ought not to see that as something that contradicts science or is problematic with the revelation. I think the laziest form of an argument against this kind of thing is, well, if this was really by God, God would have told him that or something. But God's not here in this psalm to reveal scientific knowledge about the nature of the universe, okay? God's not interested in revealing the heliocentric theory, okay? Something interesting, when there was a geocentric theory, Christians took texts like this and jumped on board with the geocentric theory, and that's why Christians get blamed for thinking the sun moves. It was scientists that came up with it first. We just dogmatized it. Both are problematic for what it's worth. But just let me encourage you, don't jump on scientific theories too fast. Sometimes they change. All right. If you've ever had more than one child, you know scientific theories change often. I mean, you know, you have kids 2 years apart. And this is not to say anything negative about medicine or whatever else, but first kid, they tell you one thing to do, and then they say, actually, you know, studies have shown in the last 2 years, you should do it differently. Well, thank God for that knowledge, right? They're studying this, they're knowing this, but as a church, we ought not to just jump on that. We shouldn't panic every time a new scientific theory seems to contradict the Bible. Because sometimes they seem to agree with the Bible, and they're wrong too. Okay. There are things about the sun, though, that are mind-boggling. The fact that if we were any closer to the sun, or really any further away from the sun, this planet would be uninhabitable. It's right where it needs to be, right? It's the perfect conditions. So David is seeing the way that the sun and you think about the uniformity of the world. Just the fact 2 + 2 = 4 every day. The sun rises, the sun sets, and we can mark calendars on this. We can mark time by this. What a beautiful thing that is. God's creation reveals his glory, and it reveals his ordered glory, and it's so good for us to remember that this God who created the heavens and the earth, filled them with good things, and ordered them according to his will, and placed man and woman there to be fruitful and multiply, to cultivate the garden, and to spread his glory over the earth like the waters cover the sea. And we can look out and we can see the world. We can see all that God has made, and we ought to look at it and say, what is man that you're mindful of him? You know, when I look at the stars, it's a beautiful thing that God created this world. And so I hope you will never give in to anything but God created the world. This is his world, and we owe everything to our Creator. We belong to him in both body and soul. Our only hope is with our Creator. I love to say we are doubly owned by the Lord Jesus Christ. Not only were we created through him and for him, we were also bought by his blood. And so as Christians, it's so important for us not only to hold to a view of creation. Before I open up for questions, we've drank this in more than we like to think we have. Okay? And I wish Christians would do less. I didn't come from no monkey. I don't think you did. A little less of that, sort of just superficial sparring with the issues, the deep issues, and a little more time developing a theology of what it means to live as if we're created and how to demonstrate createdness to a world gone crazy that's forgotten its creator. It's like one of the saddest things I've ever heard is this year, you know, every year at Thanksgiving with the rise of secularism, we're all supposed to be thankful with no one to thank. And so I wish we would do a little less, you know, like Scopes monkey trial kind of stuff, and a little more soul searching in our own hearts to try to think through and pray through, in what ways have I begun to live as if there is no God, as if this world doesn't belong to my Father, as if we aren't created, as if this world wasn't received. I really think, and I'm not saying we don't need to deal with the intellectual side of this, we do, but I think that is going to speak to a world in crisis so much more clearly than just telling them they're stupid for believing what they learned in school and in college. I think our society as a whole, but even Christians at times, have bought into a sort of fundamental unseriousness about almost everything. Just everything's kind of a joke and kind of flippant and thrown away. And we owe the world more thoughtfulness than that. Okay. So this is our Father's world. This is our Father's world. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems all so strong, God is the ruler yet. All right. Any questions? Or thoughts? But you can't say I didn't come from no monkey. That's the rule. I did pretty well with Whitney not being here tonight. It didn't get off the rails as much as it could have, guys. I'm feeling pretty good about that. Any questions? Did I answer all yours, Ben?
Most of them.
Oh, man.
I did. Some of these kind of build on one another, so I kind of lobbed this one at you first. So I think it's fair to say, and we can disagree, that within the inner Trinitarian relationship of Father, Son, and Spirit, there's nothing lacking, right?
Agreed.
Right?
I think Grudem says it. There's all the glory God's ever had it or needed is contained within the Trinity, he said.
Right.
But I would say contained within himself.
Right.
Yeah.
So the question is kind of, then why creation? Why go further?
Yeah. Here's the only thing I know of. And I have to be real careful on how to say this. I think God could have chosen not to do this. But there are aspects of God's character and nature that are true. God is glorious whether he demonstrates it or not. There are things about God's nature that are true but would not be displayed with clarity and with all the vividness they could be displayed with without creation. And in keeping with that, the fall. And vis-a-vis redemption. In other words, his benevolence, his love, but in particular, those things pouring out as grace and mercy. So I think it boils down to God choosing to create sentient thinking creatures who can behold and know his glory, and in particular, who would become objects of his redemption so that his grace and mercy could be demonstrated in an even more profound way. There's no need for grace in the Godhead, right? So God created man to lavish his mercy upon him through the gospel. That's, as a theater, Calvin would say, of his glory, for his glory. But his glory is unique. I mean, to me, the only thing that makes God's... There's two aspects of God's nature that are uniquely revealed through creation. First of all, his creativity. You know, God is creative. So Whitney and I had a big argument, like just about a fight a few weeks ago, over whether God is the eternal creator. And I say, well, her argument's really sound, which is God never changes, so he must eternally be creator. So I say, no, God is eternally creative, but not eternally creator, because there was a moment when God had to choose to create, made a decision. Okay? And so she's not going to listen to this. And she's not here, so please don't mention that I mentioned this, if you don't mind. So we had this long discussion, you know, and I say all that to say, creator, you know, God's creative, but he displays his creativity uniquely through creation. His creativity is mind-boggling. I mean, you just think about the things you can see. When you think about the creativity of what you cannot see. You see about angels with three sets of wings and stuff. I mean, there's some creativity we've no eyes beheld. anyway, so some of them are burning, apparently. You know, I mean, there's a lot going on in the angels, creativity-wise. But then second of all, grace. That's another aspect of the character of God that to me is unique to God having been creator and having to make the world to display that. To make something. Those are the two things I know of that seem to be intrinsic to who God is, unquestionably. They're part of his own character. His loving kindness. I mean, the whole Old Testament is about God's loving kindness, steadfast love in this way. And God chooses to display it to little clay figurines that can think, you know. And why he chose to do that, when he's totally satisfied, doesn't need to do this, I don't know, but chose to reveal it. And those aspects of who God is are revealed uniquely through this. It's as good of an answer as any, isn't it?
Yeah. So just to kind of carry on with that same point, nothing in all creation exists that wasn't created by God, right?
Wait, I copped out. There's another aspect. It's God's wrath also. Okay. I should have said that. That's a third thing that's uniquely revealed. God is eternally just, but his wrath is uniquely revealed through creation. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
So
start back over. On question two.
Okay, we're on question two.
Sorry.
So I think sometimes, especially in today's age, we get kind of caught up in this dualistic thought. Right?
Okay.
Of there being good, being evil. Right.
Yeah.
How do we reconcile the problem of evil with the unmoved movement, the uncreated creator?
Yeah. Okay, I'll repeat the question. Ben Ben said it can sometimes feel like we've given into a little bit of a dualism in this world, which is sort of like that good and evil are two equal, diametrically opposed forces that exist in the cosmos. So my answer, Ben, is just feed the good wolf, and I think I'm just kidding. But so then the question becomes, how do we reconcile the presence of evil and the fact that nothing that's created is not from God? Okay? Well, first of all, it's really clear there's no evil in God, and God is not the author of evil. So we have to start there because the Bible clearly reveals it. And God does allow evil. And he allows free agent sentient creatures, including angels, right, to make sinful decisions. And so in the sense that I do believe in a personal devil, that's as close to dualism, I think, as biblical Christianity gets. So I think it's important to remember, Ben, and I think one helpful thing here for the question in terms of the problem of evil is, I mean, we're still going to get back to the philosophical underpinnings of it all, but the reality is there is an evil force in the world, an actual personal evil force in the world. And frankly, I think that's where a lot of the dualism in the world comes from. I'm sure can't believe in a devil, you know. Who wants to talk about the devil at a cocktail party, you know, or whatever? And, you know, we don't do that kind of stuff. I've got an electric razor. I don't believe in the, yeah, I don't. But yeah, I do. Yeah, I've got an electric razor. I don't believe in the devil. And so that's, you know, like, we can't believe in the devil, but man, where's all this evil coming from? So there must be some evil force out there, nameless, that's cool or something, you know? And, but so there is a devil, and more people know it than you think. It's like one of my favorite Wilco songs is called Hell is Chrome. Jeff Tweedy wrote it right around the time he was about to go into rehab. And the song says, when the devil came, he wasn't red, he was chrome. In other words, he was a lot more attractive than you would have thought. He wasn't as obvious. He was slick and shiny and there. So even someone who has an electric razor, he doesn't use it, but Jeff Tweedy recognizes there's something out there that's working on him, you know. Any Wilco fans in the house? Come on, somebody. All right. Anyway, great band. So second of all, there is a sense of a lopsided dualism in that sense, right? Now that's not to say God's not sovereign, that's not to say God's not over those things, but God does allow free creatures to make evil decisions, and I think this rebellion against God's good order is what evil is. If you think about it, evil is not its own substance. Okay? Any evil or wickedness you can think of, if you really think about the most wicked thing you can think of, if you really boil down to why you think it's so bad, it's because it's so diametrically opposed to God's good design. Right? I mean, murder, you know? Love your neighbor as yourself. Why is murder so bad? You know, and if you start thinking about like, and this isn't just us, you know, this isn't just us. Like you just think about why is our society okay with any kind of sex, but just a few kinds, you know, and we're losing those quicker than I wish. You know what I mean? I really thought we were going to have a few good years where everybody agreed on pedophilia, you know. But I don't think we're getting it, guys. I'm just telling you, I don't think we're getting it. And I think we're going there real quick. But guess what? Guess who didn't care about pedophilia? The Roman Empire. It was practiced, pederasty, where old men, rich men, had boys that were their boyfriends in addition to their wives. Okay? It was a normal practice until what comes along? Christianity. And a guy named Tom Holland, not Spider-Man, wrote this book called Dominion. I think David's read it. And he kind of makes a really convincing argument that essentially everything we understand to be moral, even those who rail against Christianity, the underpinnings of it are rooted in Christianity. So I say that to say evil is not a substance of its own. It's a rejection and rebellion against God's good order. And even the things that our society retains a real negative view of are so clearly rooted in a Judeo-Christian ethic. And really, and Lewis even makes this point that even in pagan cultures, like there's not an anything goes pagan culture anywhere. There's some a lot of thing goes, but so there may be a I think Lewis says in Mere Christianity there may be a culture where a man can have more than one wife, but there's no culture in which a man can have any wife he pleases, right? And so again, even in the most primitive and what we would consider pagan and barbaric of cultures, there's still a testimony of conscience to a creator, okay? And so evil in and of itself is a rejection of God's good order and a maligning. And, you know, the devil's not creative is another way to put that. So I just say I hold these things in tension. How it is that God allows evil but is not the author of evil, I don't really know. But that's all the faults I have on that, dumped out in a very disorderly way. What time is it? Somebody asked a question before Ben asked another one. All right. I love y'all so much. Thanks for coming and listening. I appreciate you being a part. Go in peace.